This is Jenny.
And this is Amanda.
And we're from Dim the Lights with Jenny and Amanda.
Every second and fourth Tuesday of the month here on WGXC, Acre, Hudson, Catskill, 90.7 FM.
From the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, this is Democracy Now!
I raised my right arm, looked at the thousands and thousands of people that were breathlessly waiting, and started shouting, fight, fight, fight.
President Trump accepts the Republican presidential nomination just days after surviving an attempted assassination. He took the stage Thursday with a white bandage over his right ear. Trump repeatedly attacked immigrants, accused the Democrats of cheating in the 2020 election, and blasted President Biden by name.
If you took the 10 worst presidents in the history of the United States, think of it, the 10 worst, added them up, they will not have done the damage that Biden has done.
We'll speak to Bishop William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign. Then we look at why Trump and other speakers at the RNC never said the word abortion during the convention. We'll talk to Amy Littlefield, abortion access correspondent at The Nation. And we'll speak about the recent killings of two black men here in Milwaukee, Samuel Sharp and Devante Mitchell. A major march was held yesterday. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. This is War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. We're broadcasting from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm Amy Goodman. Donald Trump took to the stage to close out the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee last night. In the longest ever speech recorded at a party convention, Trump formally accepted the Republican nomination. As in previous campaign addresses, Trump promised to, quote, launch the largest deportation operation in the history of our country and drill, baby, drill. We'll have more from the RNC after headlines. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, several outlets are reporting Democratic insiders believe, quote, we're close to the end, unquote, of Biden's presidential run and that he could step down as soon as this weekend. Montana Senator John Tester, who's in a close reelection bid, became the second Democratic senator to call on Biden to drop out of the race. This comes as the Washington Post reports former President Obama has privately told allies that Biden should reconsider staying in the race. Biden is now in self-isolation after coming down with COVID. A Russian court has convicted Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich of espionage, sentencing him to 16 years in prison. Gershkovich, a U.S. citizen, was tried behind closed doors. He was arrested over a year ago and accused of spying on a military factory for the CIA. Charges the Wall Street Journal slammed as baseless. The Wall Street Journal called the conviction disgraceful and a sham. Earlier this week, Russia said it's holding talks with the U.S. on a possible prisoner swap involving Evan Gershkovich. In Gaza, Israel's bombed another U.N. school in Gaza City. It's at least the ninth U.N. school shelter Israel's attacked in the past 2 weeks. Deadly attacks have also been reported in the Brej and Nusayrat refugee camps, killing at least 13 Palestinians. In Khan Yunis, health officials exhumed and transferred the bodies of at least 12 Palestinians killed when Israel attacked and besieged the Red Crescent-run Al-Amal Hospital earlier this year. The mother of one of the victims traveled from Gaza City to retrieve her son's body.
He was martyred at the Red Crescent Hospital. They shot him and he had a loaf of bread with him, which he had to beg for to get for his daughter. They shot him in the eye and in the head. It rained on him. He was mashed with blood. He was just thrown there all day long. They weren't able to move him. They pulled him with a rope when they brought him to be buried here. I was able to know his whereabouts. They called me to inform me that my son had died. I risked my life to come here from Gaza City, but I said to myself that if I will die, I will die. So I put a piece of paper on my chest with my name on it, and I kept walking by the sea. I kept walking and asked around until I reached here with his sick father.
A new report by Oxfam finds Israel's used water as a weapon of war, with Gaza's water supplies plummeting by 94% over the past 10 months due to Israel's blockades and nonstop bombardment. Even before October 7th, Gazans' access to water was severely restricted. The destruction of Gaza's water treatment plants has forced people to resort to using sewage-contaminated water containing pathogens that lead to diarrhea, which is especially deadly for children, and diseases like cholera, dysentery, hepatitis A, and typhoid. Meanwhile, Palestinian health authorities say the polio virus has been found in sewage samples from Gaza. In the occupied West Bank, local news is reporting illegal Israeli settlers have attacked multiple Palestinian towns, including Beit Jala, where settlers stormed a school and raised Palestinian flags. Israeli forces and settlers have stepped up their attacks on the occupied West Bank since October 7th, killing over 500 Palestinians. Meanwhile, the UK announced it's resuming funding to UNRWA. Britain's new foreign minister, David Lammy, said the UK will provide £21 million to the agency. Britain joined the US and others in pausing its funding in January after Israel made unsubstantiated claims that UNRWA staffers were involved in the October 7th Hamas attacks on Israel. Rwanda's Electoral Commission confirmed President Paul Kagame has been reelected for a fourth term with over 99% of support following Monday's vote. Kagame has been in power since 2000, making him the only elected president of Rwanda since the 1994 genocide, during which up to 1 million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed by militia members. Ahead of the election, Rwanda courts banned Kagame's biggest rivals from running. Rights groups have called out Kagame's sweeping crackdown on the press and dissent, as well as his backing of M23 rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo, who have been accused of widespread abuses. In Peru, indigenous leaders have declared a state of emergency following the killing of Mariano Isacama Feliciano, leader of the Cacataibo community, whose body was found Sunday with signs of torture after being missing for over 3 weeks. Indigenous leaders are also calling on foreign governments to stop enabling the violence through their invasion and exploitation of the Amazon. This is Jorge Perez, president of the Interethnic Association for the Development of the Peruvian Rainforest.
We declare a permanent state of emergency for the government's negligence, demonstrated with 24 days of inaction after the disappearance of brother Mariano Isacama Feliciano, leader of the Cacataibo people. 35 leaders have been assassinated for defending their ancestral territory, for defending the Amazon. And we urge major changes to end the crimes and threats against indigenous defenders.
In other news from Peru, a new report by Amnesty International finds President Dina Boluarte is likely criminally responsible for the killing of 50 people during major protests between December 2022 and March 2023, following the overthrow of the leftist president Pedro Castillo. Another 1,400 were injured in the brutal crackdown by armed forces and police. On Thursday, Amnesty presented its findings in Lima alongside relatives of some of those killed in the December 15th protest. This is Giovanna Mendoza, who lost her brother and now runs an organization representing other grieving family members.
They have shot in order to kill. At no time have they only wanted to disperse the people. No, they have shot to kill because they were shooting straight at the body. Straight at the body, they were shooting with firearm projectiles at our relatives and also at the survivors who are now suffering in their homes.
And in New York, organizers say more than 1,000 Uber and Lyft drivers marched in the streets this week to protest the company's unfair pay rules. Uber started locking workers out of the app during low-demand periods in order to avoid paying them for idle time between rides. Lyft is threatening to do the same. Workers say this not only costs them wages, but makes it impossible to have a reliable work schedule. The anti-worker move was implemented as a workaround to New York City rules that require rideshare companies to pay drivers when they're on the clock, even if they're not actively driving around passengers. Unionized drivers say they could go on strike unless the policy ends.
Uber is just a corporation, a capitalist. Want to make profit. They don't care about your well-being.
And a quick correction. Israeli settlers raised Israeli flags after invading the occupied West Bank town of Beit Jala, not Palestinian flags. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. Coming up, as Donald Trump accepts a Republican presidential nomination for a third time, we'll speak to Bishop William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign.
You know Reagan is for the rich man. A poor man ain't got no way. I'm gonna tell you, rich people getting richer and poor men starving day by day. You know my poor grandmama, they cut a welfare check down. I wish I could help the poor old soul, cause I know she's going down. Play it for me, Gilhart.
Reagan is for the Rich Man by Louisiana Red. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. We're broadcasting from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, after the last evening of the Republican National Convention. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Donald Trump accepted the Republican nomination on Thursday night, just 5 days after surviving an assassination attempt. Trump gave the longest acceptance speech in convention history, clocking in at over 90 minutes. He began by recounting what happened in Butler, Pennsylvania, on Saturday, when a bullet grazed his right ear as he was giving a speech. He went on to repeatedly demonize migrants who seek refuge in the United States. He also attacked President Biden by name, despite a claim by campaign aides that he would not do so during the speech.
And then we had that horrible, horrible result that we'll never let happen again. The election result, we're never going to let that happen again. They used COVID to cheat. We're never going to let it happen again. And they took off all the sanctions and they did everything possible for Iran. And now Iran is very close to having a nuclear weapon, which would have never happened. This is a shame what this administration, the damage that this administration has done. And I say it often, if you took the 10 worst presidents in the history of the United States, think of it, the 10 worst, added them up, they will not have done the damage that Biden has done. Only going to use the term once, Biden. I'm not going to use the name anymore, just one time. The damage that he's done to this country is unthinkable. It's unthinkable.
We're joined now by Bishop William Barber, National Co-Chair of the Poor People's Campaign, also President and Senior Lecturer, Repairers of the Breach, Founding Director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. He's co-author of a new book, White Poverty, how exposing myths about race and class can reconstruct American democracy. Bishop Barber, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't we start off with your response to the Republican convention of this week? I think one of the big takeaways of this convention, as Republicans talked about unity, is unifying people against marginalized communities, particularly throughout the week, speaker after speaker vilified everyone from immigrants to trans students.
Well, Amy, thank you for having me. I think you're exactly right. It was a unity of rejection, rejecting people in this American society. It was a unity in those who are against women's right to choose, even though they tried to hide that, because you have to read the whole platform. It was unity against immigrants, but it also, what they didn't say, there was no conversation about the poor, 140 million poor, low-wage people in this country. It was a unity against labor rights, a unity against voting rights, a unity against living wages, a unity against health care for all. This was a very extreme, extreme convention, even though we had just gone through an attempted assassination, which I renounced violence and praying for the president, his family, and the person who died and their families and all of them. But it was almost as though it hadn't happened. What you saw is that they went to the podium and the mic. They may have toned down their voices, but they did not tone down the extreme policies.
Bishop Barber, if you could speak, your book that's just out is titled White Poverty, How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. Talk about what you think ought to have been said throughout this convention on the crisis of poverty in the country that transcends race.
Well, when we talk about it, but white poverty, what we're trying to say is that most of the time we talk about poverty in the media and other places, somebody puts up a black woman on welfare, which is racist toward black people, and it is dismissive of tens of millions of white people. There are 26 million poor, low-wealth black people, about 58-60% of the black population, and 66 million poor, low-wealth white people, which is 30% of the white population. But there is this attempt to marginalize poverty and not address it and suggest it's a marginal issue, when in fact it impacts 140 million people in this country. Poverty kills 800 people a day, 295,000 people a year, the fourth leading cause of death, and we can solve it. It is abolishable. It is solvable through living wages and child tax credits and earned income tax credits and health care for all and fully funded public education. But what we didn't hear at this convention that should have been heard is, how are you going to address these issues? In fact, that was the real failure of the first debate. The poor and low-wage people are 30% of the electorate now, 40% in battleground states. The first debate didn't ask either candidate, what will you do about living wages? What will you do about earned income tax credit? What will you do about making sure people have paid family leave and health care? What will you do about social safety net programs for the disabled and the hurting and the poor among us? How will you address this American crisis, an American crisis? How will you address this epidemic of policy death that comes through poverty and not addressing poverty? None of that was raised. How will you address voting rights? In the Republican platform, it's addressed by not addressing it or saying they're against it. We'll wait to see about the Democratic platform. But that is a failure of our society to constantly have debate after debate after debate, convention after convention after convention, and write off over 43% of the adults in this country, which are poor and low-wage, and over 51% of our children.
Bishop Barber, you know, to go back to another point that you make in your book, you say the shared experience of poverty has the potential to unite a movement for genuine change. And as you were saying earlier, the rhetoric through the convention has been one of division. But I'd like to ask you about one specific claim that Trump made in his speech last night about jobs, Americans losing jobs, American citizens allegedly losing jobs to migrants. He said, in fact, that 107% of those jobs are taken by illegal aliens. So leaving apart the fact that 107% is impossible, he goes on to make the distinction that it is the black population and the Hispanic population, it is their jobs that migrants are taking. If you could explain what you think the effects and the purpose of this kind of rhetoric is, this constant division between groups.
Yeah, well, in white poverty, we talk about how there's this mythology that you make poverty a black issue or brown issue, and you split people that so that the greedy can work within the divisions. I think they call it positive polarization in the so-called Southern strategy. And what we're saying is that whether you're in Appalachia and you're poor, or whether you're in the Delta, you're poor. If you can't pay your light, you can't pay your light bill, we're all in essence black in the dark. We need to bind people together. That what he did was a slick way of trying to pit people against one another, saying to black people and brown and others that you should be against immigrants. When in fact, as you said, you can't be 107, the percentage is off. His facts are off, it's not true. His policies cost us jobs. His tariff policies cost the American people paid for it, according to economists, and we lost some 300,000 jobs. His refusal to support health care cost us jobs, because when you pass universal health care, not only to keep people healthy, but it also provides a job. His refusal to pass living wages hurt 55 million poor and low-wage people that make less than $15 an hour every day in this country. His refusal to raise the minimum wage, he actually in one speech said it was too high, $7.25 an hour, that has been since 2009. So what Trump was trying to do is play this division against one another, black job versus white job versus brown job, rather than uniting people together. And that's one other thing about this convention. What we saw is he's never gotten a majority of the American people. He's won through the Electoral College. He said that God was on his side, and when he did not get killed, and thank God he did not kill. We have to renounce that violence, and thank God something worse didn't happen. But here's the other theological side. If God is on your side, then how do your policies reflect that? Because God cares about the poor. God cares about the least of these. God, throughout the scripture, cares about the worker and says the worker is worthy of his right. What he engaged in after saying God was not on his, was on his side, was he lied. He lied over and over again. He engaged in idolatry, I and I alone. I've never heard the likes of idolatry. I and I alone can fix the economy. I and I alone can stop war. I and I alone can prevent World War III. He attacked President Biden with a lie that he's worse than the worst 10 presidents combined. He did not tell the truth about how his policies actually hurt poor and working people. He's against labor rights. He's against union rights. He's against living wages. And over again, you know, lie after lie after lie. And then he would not talk about what's really in the platform so that American people could hear what's in the platform. So I'm deeply concerned when you say God is on your side, which we are thankful for the grace of God. But when Theodore Roosevelt was shot, after he was shot, he then promoted living wages and health care, environmental protection. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt was almost assassinated, he supported the New Deal and Social Security and living wages. When Kennedy was shot and killed, Johnson then went on to push the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. The question is, what do you do if you've received grace? How does your policies reflect the grace that you claim to receive? And I didn't see a lot of that or hear that in the speech that we heard last night.
Other speakers on the final night of the Republican National Convention included former Fox host Tucker Carlson. While he made no mention of Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election, Carlson claimed Donald Trump is trying to restore democracy to the United States.
From the famous escalator ride 9 years ago until today of Donald Trump's public life has been to remind us of one fact, which is a leader's duty is to his people, to his country, and to no other. That's the point. That's the only point. And another word for this is democracy. Democracy, in case you're a little sick of being beaten in the face with democracy on television? Actual democracy is the proposition that the citizens of a country own that country. They're not renters, they're not serfs, they're not slaves, they are the owners of the country. And for that to be true, their leaders have to represent them, which is another way of saying they have to do what the people want them to do, or a close approximation thereof. But if they completely ignore what people want, not just 1 year, but generationally, say for 50 years, then it may be, I don't know what, it's not a democracy. And so I think the entire Trump project, paradoxically, is attacked as an enemy of democracy, is to return democracy to the United States.
So that was Tucker Carlson addressing the Republican National Convention. He was forced out of Fox News. Bishop Barber, can you respond to what he said?
Well, I can see why he was forced out, because they, you know, I just call it lying. I mean, people try to say twisting words. You know, you had a lot of people speak at that convention that had called Trump everything from an American Hitler. That's what J.D. Vance said, and Tucker Carlson and others of them had negative things to say. Now they're saying he's the beholder, he's the keeper of democracy. You turn loose people on January 6th to lie about an election and cause an insurrection, you're a protector of democracy? No. You claim that there's voter suppression, I mean, voter fraud when there's not? No. You put justices on the Supreme Court who uphold voter suppression rather than stop it? No. Your party has been the party that has produced over 1,000 different bills in state houses to suppress the vote, and you claim you're for democracy. No. You stand up and say you and you alone. That doesn't sound like the people. That sounds like you. You push policies that are against what the majority of Americans want. Americans want living wages, but they're not pushing living wages. Americans want universal health care. They're not pushing universal health care. And the majority of Americans want those things. And so what you have here is the ability to gauge in smoke and mirrors. My grandmother used to have a saying that you can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig. But the danger of that is to lie with such a straight face and to be actually the antithesis of one thing. For instance, to name something, as many extremists do who claim themselves to be Republican, a freedom party, but then you participate in the kind of policies that are against freedom. It is a lesson in hypocrisy at the deepest level of what we saw during this convention. And it doesn't matter if your voice is easy and quiet and you claim to do unity and you're just not screaming and hollering. The substance was so subversive to this experiment of democracy. And Amy, if I might say, you know, I'm praying for Democrats now, you know, as they are talking about what they're going to do and their candidate, because many of us, I, as a private citizen, support the Biden-Harris ticket. But I'm concerned about how they are processing asking the president, those that are saying you ought to step down, because they're saying because of the polls, you ought to step down. Well, polls don't vote. We that's not a part of our Constitution. They're saying, well, because your age, well, we don't have an age requirement except you can't be but so young. They're saying that you ought to step down because of health. Well, health in itself is not a cause to step down, because if that was the case, Theodore Roosevelt, Lincoln, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, nor Kennedy would have qualified for the presidency and been able to serve. We have a process in place. One, if you want to be in, then run during the primary. Two, we have the 25th Amendment. Three, the president can step down and the vice president takes over. That's why we have a vice president. But this notion of calling someone to step out, opening up the convention because folk threaten to take money back, threaten to are talking about polls in July and in August is very concerning because of the way it undermines the democratic process. We have a process in place in this country. If you believe somebody should not be in office, they're too old, too young, too inexperienced, too frail, then run against them. If they're incapacitated, 25th Amendment. If they resign, then the vice president takes over. And we've got to be careful in this moment. What I think ought to happen is that we ought to support a ticket that is there and push issues, get away from just the candidates and promote the issues that they support and then mobilize the biggest swing vote in the country, which is poor and low wage, infrequent voters, 30 million of them, and young people, and tell them what the issues are, and lay out a 100-day plan, and let people vote for that, and then follow the processes that are already in our Constitution, because you have to be very careful that you don't, in an effort to do something, actually set precedents that are contrary to the constitutional provisions that we already have existing in this country.
Bishop William Barber, I want to thank you for being with us, national co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, president and senior lecturer at Repairers of the Breach, founding director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School, co-author of the new book, White Poverty: How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. We're broadcasting from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, throughout this week as we come to the conclusion of the Republican National Convention.
On Thursday, Donald Trump spoke for over 90 minutes in the longest convention speech in history. One word he never mentioned was abortion, or the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade, thanks to three conservative judges he appointed. Republican vice president candidate J.D. Vance also did not mention the word abortion once. In fact, according to the Washington Post, the word abortion wasn't mentioned a single time from the stage during at least the first 3 days of the convention. However, this week, CNN did unearth a 2022 comment by Vance where he said he supports a national abortion ban.
Do you think it will be resolved nationally?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly would like abortion to be legal nationally.
To talk more about what was not talked about at the RNC, we're joined by Amy Littlefield, abortion access correspondent at The Nation. Amy, welcome back to Democracy Now! So we're talking a lot about what the president and other Republican speakers spoke of this week, the main theme, vilification of immigrants. They didn't talk about abortion, but certainly that is a major theme of what President Trump wants to do in this next term. Can you talk about what was and hasn't been talked about?
I mean, not one single word about abortion from Donald Trump last night in all 92-plus minutes of that speech. Not one single word from J.D. Vance, who we know is a diehard abortion opponent. I mean, this is stunning, Amy, even though I knew to expect it. To see Donald Trump talk more about crime rates in Venezuela and El Salvador than he did about what is arguably the crowning conservative achievement of his entire presidency, which is handing conservatives this 50-year-long dream, you know, the culmination of this 50-year-long dream they've had of overturning Roe v. Wade. I mean, this is arguably his most unequivocal victory, and he doesn't mention it once. Again, I knew to expect it because I know that Republicans can read the polls. They know that abortion has triumphed in all seven instances where it's been on the ballot since the Dobbs decision. They know that a rising number of people support abortion rights. They know that 79% of people oppose the idea of a nationwide abortion ban. And so it's no surprise. And yet it really felt like the end of an era to me. I mean, I felt like I was watching the end of 40-plus years where Republicans have opportunistically used the issue of abortion to win elections. And now they're suddenly taking abortion by the shoulder and shuffling her off the stage and saying, you know, well done, you served your purpose, you helped us, you know, consolidate power over the last, you know, 40-odd years, and we're not going to talk about you anymore. There's several really important caveats here that I want to highlight. I mean, one is that the fact that Republicans aren't talking about abortion does not in any way mean that they're not going to continue to act on it, right? I mean, if you read the Republican Party platform, it's clear they're endorsing the idea that the 14th Amendment to the Constitution protects fetal personhood, protects the due process and equal rights of embryos. If you read Project 2025, it's clear they believe that the Comstock Act from 1873, right, another instance of a Victorian-era law coming back to life potentially from the history books, is a de facto nationwide ban on the mailing of abortion pills. And so they're using these ways that don't actually require any public buy-in, potentially. I think we can see their plan is to go for a nationwide ban on abortion that doesn't require the approval of Congress, that doesn't require the democratic process, because they're going to go back into the history books and, you know, revive this law potentially from an era when, you know, it was used to go after obscene books and pornographic drawings. So the other really important caveat, Amy, as you've covered on this show, I mean, it seems clear that the new found target that's been tapped to replace abortion is transgender people, and in particular transgender children, some of the most vulnerable people in this country. The punchline about women's sports, about like, well, at least our side knows, you know, the difference between men and women. I mean, that was a drumbeat as much as drill, baby, drill, as much as the anti-immigrant rhetoric at this convention. 625 anti-trans bills introduced this year, a record. I mean, I used to sit here and say that same, you know, similar numbers when we were talking about anti-abortion legislation years ago. So we're really talking about that same anti-abortion playbook now being trained on transgender people because Republicans think that's going to be more popular.
Well, Amy Littlefield, I mean, it may be because of the silence from the stage on the question of abortion that many media reports seem to conclude that the Republican Party is now softening its stance on abortion. Do you believe that's true?
Far from it, Nermeen. I'm so glad you asked that question. I mean, it was widely reported when the Republican Party platform came out that they were softening their stance on abortion. And that's because it mentions, you know, states getting to have a say in abortion. First of all, I want to push back on this idea that allowing states to decide on abortion is in any way a moderate stance, right? We have now total bans in at least 14 states in this country. We're witnessing nightmare scenarios where hemorrhaging women are being airlifted to neighboring states by helicopter, where people in the process of miscarrying are coming close to death, where people in states like Texas experiencing pregnancy complications are dying, where people are being consigned to pregnancy against their will. Okay, that's under the scenario now, which is states deciding, right, which is a deeply unequal system. But secondly, they're not giving up on the idea of a nationwide ban, and that's very clear when you read the text of the Republican platform itself, which endorses the idea that the 14th Amendment protects the constitutional rights of embryos and fetuses. And if that is the case, that the 14th Amendment already protects embryos and fetuses, then we don't need a new constitutional amendment or a bill passed by Congress to ban abortion nationwide, because they can make the argument that fetuses are already people. Look, it's right here in the Constitution. And that argument, of course, would have ramifications for in vitro fertilization. It would have ramifications for contraception. And so far from being a softening of the stance, I think we have to be really concerned about this effort to, again, go back to existing texts, you know, understanding that abortion is more popular than any candidate in this election, and she'd win today if you put her on the top of the ticket. You know, they're looking for ways to do this through anti-democratic backdoor channels, and the platform has it right there in plain text. And I think much of the media really missed the mark when they accepted the idea that this was a softening.
So, Amy, as we begin to wrap up right now, if you can talk about the map right here, you know, something about the Republican and Democratic conventions, you know, every state has a post and it says its state. But the map of abortion access in this country right now and the significance of who is president, who gets to appoint judges, not just Supreme Court justices, but federal judges on down, and why that matters so much when it comes to the issue of reproductive rights and abortion.
It matters so much, Amy. I mean, we've seen what Trump's three appointees to the Supreme Court have done, wreaking havoc not just on abortion rights, but on a host of other issues underpinning our democracy. I mean, the map of abortion access right now, you know, I was recently in Florida, which is one of at least six states that's going to have a ballot initiative on abortion this election. These ballot initiatives are what I'm going to be watching very closely. Florida has a six-week ban in place now. Florida used to be the destination state. It was like a funnel into which, you know, patients from all across the South would travel. 84,000 abortions, I believe, last year. And now they can only do abortions up until 6 weeks. And so I sat in the waiting room of a clinic in Florida and watched people being sorted into groups based on the difference of a few millimeters of growth on an embryo the size of a pea, right? Whether they were 6 weeks one day and they were too late, or whether they were 5 weeks 3 days and or 5 weeks 4 days and they could get an abortion still in the state of Florida. So people in Florida are going to be voting directly on this issue. That's also the case in Nevada and a number of other states. It could be the case in several other states, including the swing state of Arizona. So I think abortion is going to have a huge impact on this election. But I also want to say, you know, it's kind of incredible that we have, you know, the two top of the ticket candidates, at least right now as we're speaking in this moment, are Donald Trump, who, you know, declared himself very pro-choice many years back in 1999, right? And Joe Biden, Joe not so big on abortion Biden, or not big on abortion Biden, who, you know, in the 70s and 80s went so far as to vote against rape exceptions and incest exceptions in the federal funding ban, the Hyde Amendment, the ban on Medicaid federal funding of abortion, and where, you know, these are kind of the two people to choose between in an election where abortion is going to be one of the primary issues. I think the Democratic Party really needs to articulate a strong pro-abortion stance that doesn't just involve, you know, abortion up until viability and for rape and incest victims, right? And I think to the point of what your previous guest was saying, we need a reproductive justice New Deal. We need a platform for 2024 that is about economic justice as well as abortion and that ties those two issues together if the Democrats are going to win.
Amy Littlefield, I want to thank you for being with us, abortion access correspondent at The Nation magazine. Next up, we look at the recent killings of two black men here in Milwaukee. Samuel Sharp was a homeless veteran, and Devante Mitchell was killed by security guards outside the Hyatt, where delegates are swarming through right now, where journalists are getting their press credentials. More in a minute.
Attend a funeral. It is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry. No more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth will someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go, all suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go.
We will all go together when we go, by Tom Lehrer. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. We're broadcasting from Milwaukee just after the last night of the Republican National Convention. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Here in Milwaukee, protesters marched on Thursday through downtown to call for justice for Samuel Sharp and Devante Mitchell. Samuel Sharp was a 43-year-old unhoused black man who was shot dead in Milwaukee by police officers from Ohio who were here in Wisconsin as part of a group of 4,500 law enforcement officials here for the RNC. The shooting took place a mile from the RNC's proceedings. Sharp's death came weeks after security guards at the Hyatt Regency Hotel in Milwaukee killed Devante Mitchell. The 43-year-old black father died after security guards pinned him to the ground.
Democracy Now! Was at the protest and march on Thursday. This is Katrina Games, the aunt of Sam Sharp. But first we hear from Naisha Mitchell, the big sister of Devante Mitchell.
My name name is Naisha Mitchell. Devante was my brother. I was his big sister. We are definitely going to keep fighting for justice here. We appreciate all you guys' support. We just ask for the community to keep on coming out here with us, keep standing with us until we get some answers. You know, no one has been charged. No one has been arrested. They're saying that they're waiting on autopsy results, but we saw the video. We all saw the video. Why do we need autopsy results to determine if these people need to be arrested or convicted of a crime? We saw them murder him in broad daylight. We need answers, and we want it now, and we need justice now.
My name is Katrina Gaines. I'm here on behalf of my nephew for his mother's sake. Now, most people that know Sam Sharp, they know that he has MS and he doesn't. His gait is unbalanced. He wanted to be on his own with his MS. He didn't want us to feel like we had to take care of him or burden him. He told us all that God told him to go and help in that community. Jesus. And that's what he did. But for the police to just shoot him like that, 27 bullets, come on, wow. And you shot my nephew wow. like that. Jesus. You shot him. Jesus. It didn't take Cowards. All of that. If he was someone else, if he was a different race, and I hate to bring race in this because I have all races in my family, but you wouldn't have killed him like that. You wouldn't have shot him like that. 27 bullets, and all this he was doing was trying to protect himself. He went to the police and they did nothing. And now my nephew is shot. He is shot and he is dead, and it is just horrible.
For more, we're joined by two guests here in Milwaukee. Angelique Sharp is the sister of Sam Sharp Jr., shot 27 times by Columbus, Ohio police officers near the Republican National Convention, about a mile away on Tuesday. And we're joined by Wisconsin State Representative Darren Madison, whose district includes Milwaukee. He's a member of Democratic Socialists of America. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Angelique, I met you yesterday at the rally that ended at the Hyatt. You were in Red Hour Park. And first, my condolences on the death of your brother. You are very brave to come here today because you just lost him. Can you tell us what happened to Sam? I mean, the fact that officers from Columbus, Ohio, who are coming to the RNC to be part of the thousands of police officers here for this national security event, open fire on your brother. Explain.
Thank you for your condolences. First and foremost, the situation from our perspective is that Sam, he had actually complained about a bully that lived in the shelterless community down there. He actually called on Saturday. The police have not contacted our family, asked for any, not a question. I phone logged.
Just to be clear, you're saying that your brother Sam called the police for help?
At least that's what we're under the understanding, that he called the police for help. But he called home, and he came home that day as well. He called home Saturday, and I called him, and he had told my mother that he was feared for his life. Someone told him that they were going to kill him, his dog, and burn his tent down. He was afraid. And my mother was hysterical. She said, and she called me. She said, Angelique, call Sam. I called Sam. He answered the phone. He repeated this to me. And he said, Angelique, you know, I was like, well, what you want me to do? And he was like, well, I really don't want you involved, you know, down here, because you don't know anything about this community.
You're talking about the kind of the unhoused encampment
absolutely.
Where he had moved out of the house to live.
Absolutely. Like, I would go visit him and, you know, give him money or ask him, was he okay, or batteries or whatever that he might need. But I didn't, like, hang out down there or anything like that. And so he didn't want me to just be immersed in the community like that. So he was like, he basically said that, you know, if this person tries to come for him, he's going to have to protect himself and not to go down there. Then that was Saturday. T- Tuesday, the day that this happened, he came home at about 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. He said that whoever this was chased him out of the encampment to the house. So he left his dog Isis down there, and he complained again to my mother that this person was trying to make good on what they said they was going to try to, you know, to premeditated murder. And so ultimately, they got into a standoff. And what we're seeing in the video, the body cam, is a video without context. So,
and meaning you're seeing Sam with what in his hands?
So he does have, like, we believe that they were paring knives, that he was, like, open. Like, a lot of the shelterless community may not have regular appliances and tools that you have in the kitchen. They will open cans and eat out of whatever. And so maybe he had already had this, you know, around.
And you're saying it was to protect himself. He also had MS?
He had MS, which would have affected his balance, his hearing, and this person knew that Sam wasn't, everybody down there knew Sam was not physically stealth to stand.
Even the local police knew him.
They knew.
But they were local police.
They were local
police.
And
these were police from Ohio who'd come in to supposedly provide security for the convention.
They don't have any clue about that community at all.
So they opened fire.
And
they were far from him.
And so a couple of things that come into play that really have us baffled is, one, Sam has MS that affects your hearing. Two, nobody's talking about this happened on 15th and the Lee. On 16th Street is one of the most busy thoroughfare streets in the city. The traffic, this is high noon. We're talking about noontime, lunchtime traffic in the middle of a workday. Loud vehicles. So on top of him not being able to hear and traffic, how are you supposed to hear police from that far away telling you to give any commands? And not only that, in the video, it backs it up, because neither one of the men responded to the they could hear. Otherwise, there's no way that both of them didn't turn around and respond. They're both. And I want to debunk the narrative that this person life was in danger. I've never seen a person come to a quote unquote knife fight that's in danger, that's engaging with, quote unquote, the perpetrator. Why aren't you running? Why aren't you, if you are imminent danger and you're scared for your life, there's no way that 25 or 30 police officers, or however many it is, put that many brains together and talked about he had a knife, and that's the only conclusion you came up with, was to go down there and shoot him and kill him dead like that.
Well, Representative Darren Madison, if you could respond to this tragic incident and the fact that black people in Wisconsin are nearly six times more likely to be killed by police than white people. If you could just say what specific measures you're advocating.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one, I want to uplift that, you know, that community over there, there's repairs of the breach in that neighborhood, which is 24-hour day shelter that provides services for folks who are unhoused in that community, that's why that encampment is there, and that's why local law enforcement know a lot of the folks not in that community and know how to navigate those relationships. As it relates to the broader context of our local communities, you know, we black folks in this city have navigated police violence since the 1950s. That was one of the first killings of a black male by the hands of law enforcement reported in our state. And that has only happened more and more times throughout history. In recent years, that's happened a series of times, which has led to communities crying for real change as it relates to law enforcement procedures and practices to ensure that folks can be safe in their own community. Some of the bills that, you know, I've been working on over the past year have called for, one, police decertification for law enforcement when law enforcement officers are involved in these situations and they are found guilty. What often happens is instead of being held accountable, a law enforcement officer will quit and then go work in another department in another community nearby, right?
And you have in the case of Devante Mitchell, and let's just be clear, Sam was killed on Tuesday. Devante was killed, June 30th. Mm-hmm. That was a few weeks ago. And he was held down, not by police, but by security guards. And I have to say, yesterday when we went to the Hyatt, and I went to the different police to say, can you tell me where exactly Devante Mitchell was killed? They would say, I don't know. You know, I am from Chicago, or I am from—and they named all these different places. Ohio, I am from—because there were all different law enforcement. And, of course, the local police, they also wouldn't tell me.
Yep.
But these weren't even police. They were security guards that he was held down.
Yep.
Explain and then talk about what you're demanding, what police have responded in both cases.
Yeah. So in the case of Devante, what had happened was there was the staff claimed that there was he was being disruptive
in the Hyatt.
It eventually led to them assaulting him in the space. Apparently, he ended up in the bathroom a women's bathroom at some point. And then was chased outside, in which he was pinned down on the ground by at least two confirmed security guards. The other two folks, it wasn't confirmed if they were security or they were Hyatt staff. What we do know is that the Hyatt has fired that security team, as well as a few other staffers who worked in the space for not being compliant with their own policies. What that tells us. The lawyer of Devante's family said it best, is that there is skepticism, at least from the Hyatt's perspective, in that whole altercation. When Milwaukee law enforcement arrived, they found him unresponsive and tried to resuscitate him, and he sadly lost his life. What we know was his last words was, "I'm sorry." And often in these situations, where folks are losing their lives, they are pleading with someone who has dominance for their life, and they don't respond and do anything. That hurts.
And the videotape in both cases is devastating. We only have 30 seconds, but Angelique, we're talking, this is our last segment here in Milwaukee. Outside the Republican convention, has the Trump team gotten in touch with you? Have your local police gotten in touch with you?
They absolutely have not. And I don't understand, when we have evidence that Sam called home, the shelterless community down there, by all accounts of his character and the character of the other person, it's absolutely not making sense.
What do you want right now as you speak to a global audience? We have about 10 seconds.
Yes, I want transparency. We want not the clips of the video. We want full clips. We want the autopsy report. We really want justice for my brother.
Well, we're not going to stop here, even as we go back to New York. I want to thank you both for being with us. Angelique Sharp, again, condolences, sister of Sam Sharp Jr., an unhoused black man killed by Columbus, Ohio police, not far from the Republican convention on Tuesday. And Wisconsin State Representative Darren Madison, his district includes Milwaukee, where Devante Mitchell was killed. We thank you so much for being with us. We'll continue to follow this case. Breaking news, the International Court of Justice has ruled Israel's settlement policy